And this particular sutta I like because it counters an idea that many people have. There's an idea that Buddhism, especially Theravada Buddhism, focuses on. It's all about monastics, and you have to... You read in Mahayana kind of polemical stuff about the Theravada. They say, oh, according to Theravada Buddhism, I've read this in books on Buddhism for children, it says, according to Theravada Buddhism, you have to be a monk or a nun to get enlightened, and the best lay people can do is make merit and so forth. But that's not what the Buddha taught at all. And you can see that by reading the Buddha's actual words. You can get enlightened as a lay person or layman or laywoman, but it's more difficult. The reason people become monks and nuns is to make the job easier, as simple as that. But you can get enlightened, you can make lots of spiritual progress. And the Buddha also, he didn't just give teachings to monks and nuns. He was talking most of the time to monks and nuns, so most of the things we've got come down to us. They were collected by the monks, apart from one book. There was one book of suttas which was collected by a laywoman, but all the others were collected by the monks. So naturally, they're the ones that the teachings he gave to the monks, but he gave lots of teachings to lay people as well. And there were always monks around to hear them. Another kind of misunderstanding that is common is the idea that Buddhism is all about, obviously renunciation is important, but the idea that you've got to be, as a lay person, you've got to give up anything fun and be miserable. Last time I gave a talk here, I tried to talk about that kind of thing, that it's not, you don't have to be so extreme. And so it's good to see the teaching like this. This is one of the reasons. If you just come in, if you can find somebody else, you might be able to share with someone or something, because there's these photocopies handed out, so you can kind of read along. Okay, so I'll just start reading it. But please, it's not very long, so if anything comes up and you think, oh, that's interesting, or that I don't understand that, or I find that confusing, or that doesn't seem right, or if you've got anything to add, then please pipe up, or at least at the end, it won't take very long to get through it. And give me your thoughts, and I'm interested to hear what other people got to think about this sutta, whether people like it or not, and so forth. So don't be shy to speak up, because I was hoping it might stimulate thought. Okay. So, the proper use of wealth. Oh, and as a bit of background, Anathapindika. He mentions Anathapindika here, the household Anathapindika. If you don't know, many of you will, that Anathapindika was one of the very devoted lay disciples of the Buddha, and he was very wealthy, and he supported the Sangha, and he was very, very devoted to the Buddha, and to Sariputta, actually. He was basically, in today's terms, he was a multimillionaire. He was a businessman. It's like in today's terms, he'd be a rich banker or something. Which again shows you don't. If you're rich, doesn't mean you're bad. Doesn't mean you're evil. Actually, it mentions in the suttas after he died, he was reborn as a devatar, reborn in heaven. So the householder Anathapindika. Then the householder Anathapindika approached the Blessed One, and the Blessed One said to him, householder, there are these four things that are wished for, loved, and agreeable, yet rarely gained in the world. What four? One thinks, may wealth come to me in righteous ways. This is the first thing in the world that is wished for, agreeable, and yet rarely gained in the world. Having gained wealth in righteous ways, one thinks, may fame spread about me concerning me, as well as my relatives and teachers. This is the second thing that is wished for, loved, and agreeable, yet rarely gained in the world. Having gained fame, wealth and fame, one thinks, may I live long and attain longevity, I never know how to pronounce that word. May I live long, have a long life. This is the third thing that is wished for but rarely gained. Having gained wealth, fame, and longevity, one thinks, with the breakup of the body after death, may I be reborn in a good destination, in a heavenly world. This is the fourth thing that is wished for yet rarely gained. These are the four things that are wished for, loved, and agreeable, yet rarely gained in the world. There are, householder, four other things that lead to the obtaining of those four things. What for? Accomplishment in faith, accomplishment in virtue, accomplishment in generosity, and accomplishment in wisdom. And what, householder, is accomplishment in faith? Here, a noble disciple has faith. He places faith in the enlightenment of the Tathagata thus. Now, this, if he's rather annoying thing about all these books, they shorten it, but this is the standard praise to the Buddha that follows here. So, the Blessed One is an Arahant, fully enlightened, I can't remember quite how it goes in the English, supreme teacher of gods and humans, and so forth. The enlightened one, the blessed one. So in other words, it's a standard way of saying, yeah, this is somebody who has complete faith in the Buddha. You know, he was totally enlightened, the wisest human being who's ever lived. You know, he's fully enlightened. This is called accomplishment in faith. And what is accomplishment in virtue? Here, a noble disciple abstains from the destruction of life, from stealing, from sexual misconduct, from false speech, and from wines, liquors, and intoxicants, which are a basis for negligence. This is called accomplishment in virtue. In other words, he keeps the five precepts. These are the five precepts. And what is accomplishment in generosity? Here, a noble disciple dwells at home with a mind free from the stain of stinginess, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in relinquishment, when devoted to charity, delighting in giving and sharing. This is called accomplishment in generosity. And what is accomplishment in wisdom? One dwells with a heart overcome by covetousness and unrighteous greed. One who dwells with a heart overcome by covetousness and unrighteous greed, by ill will, by sloth and torpor, by restlessness and worry, and by doubt, does what he should avoid and neglects his duty. As a consequence, his fame and happiness degenerate. When a noble disciple thus understands that these qualities are defilements of the mind, he abandons them. When he has abandoned them, he is called a disciple of great wisdom, of vast wisdom, one who sees the range of wisdom, one accomplished in wisdom. This is called accomplishment in wisdom. So actually, before you turn your pages, I mean, I'd like to stop there and to talk about that kind of passage. So there's a few interesting things. First of all, I think most people can relate to this. Basically, what most people want, these are many of the things that people wish for in the world. People want to be at least well off, you know, and you know, or even rich. Many people want to be. So this is very, very commonly wished for, and yet it's very, very. Most people aren't rich. Most people struggle, as you know, especially at times like now. But this is what people want. People also want kind of respect. You know, people like to be famous. In fact, even more so nowadays, it's become a kind of epidemic of obsession with fame, it seems, in recent years. But also you want to be kind of thought well of, you know, which is, I think, probably what the Buddha is talking more about here. You know, just thought well of in the community. And this is something that comes along with being kind of well off, you're kind of pillar of the society and so forth. And again, this is something people like to be, you know, they're well off, they're an upstanding citizen. Again, most people want to live a long life and enjoy what they've got for as long as they can. And preferably, ideally, not die at all, but since people know they have to die, then it's well, that'll be a long, long time away from now, and when I do, I want to go to heaven. So this is kind of what people want in life. And it's interesting that the Buddha, when he's talking to monks and things, he's actually saying, you know, for a monk, it's just like to practice with the idea of being reborn in a heavenly world is a pretty shameful attitude for a monk. You should be practicing to not be reborn anywhere, to not come back, to be enlightened. But when lay people went to the Buddha and said, I've heard that you know how to be reborn in the Brahma realm. And the Buddha said, yeah, I know what you have to do to be reborn in the Brahma realm. And they said, well, please teach me. And then he would teach them. Not always. In some cases, if he presumably realized that they could go for something better, then he would say, never mind about that, let me teach you wisdom. But usually, he would say, okay, well, if you want to be reborn with Brahma, the kind of god of Brahmanism, who's a very nice God compared to the God of Judeo-Christianity, totally loving, just love for all beings. The image you have of him is this big, jolly, kind of chubby, happy person, basically. And so if you want to be reborn in Rama's realm, then just practice loving-kindness. If you practice that for your lifetime, then when you die, you'll be reborn in Rama's realm. And he teaches people this, and they die, and they get reborn in the Brahma realm. So he wouldn't put them off, necessarily, because this is what people aspire to. So here we have... And here's another example of where this is, well, this is, okay, if you want these kind of things, this is what you should do. So the first thing talks about these aspirations, which are very common aspirations, all of us want, really, to some extent or another. Whether we're lay or in lay life or in... household, the word householder is just the word they use, it's the translation he uses, meaning somebody who's not a monk or a nun. A family person, basically. But if these things are really kind of common, maybe not the wealth, but you want to be thought well of and so forth and live long. This is no matter who you are, really. So then he teaches how to accomplish this. Now, it's worth pointing out, I didn't even know this myself until I read the introduction to this book. It's a very good introduction by Bhikkhu Bodhi, talking about the kind of teaching. And he says that again and again, if you read... because he's read through the entire canon. Yeah. If you read the kind of teachings the Buddha gives to lay people, again and again, there are four qualities at which he, again and again and again, he praises and recommends people in the family life to develop. And these are those four qualities. Faith, generosity next, or was it faith? Where are you looking at? Faith, virtue, of course, yeah. Faith, virtue, generosity, and wisdom. And like in Thailand, in traditional Buddhist countries, a lot of the talks to lay people aren't about kind of anatta, no self and things. They'll be about generosity and sila, virtue, and encouraging people for the faith they tend to have. The people listening to the talks tend to already come with that. This is worth noting that if you develop your faith, develop your virtue, there's also another... And like nice little sutta where this old couple come to the Buddha. They've lived together their entire lives since they were teenagers. They were betrothed, or even younger perhaps, and they got married as young adults. They lived their entire lives together, totally in love with each other, and never wished to be apart. And then they say, "All I wish now is that after I die, I'm reborn with my husband." And the husband says the same thing. And the Buddha says, "Well, basically, if your faith, generosity, virtue, and wisdom are the same with each other, then because of your attachment and your desire, then you will be reborn. You're likely to be reborn together and be with each other in the next life." So I think that's interesting. That what might tear them apart, despite their desire to be together, would be if one had a strong faith and the other one didn't, or one was a generous person but the other one wasn't. Then the karma that one's making would lead them in a different direction. If you're a very generous person, then you're kind of on the upward path. But if you're very stingy, then you're not. So you're liable to split apart there. So these are important qualities. And the other kind of strange and interesting thing. Faith. That's sort of standard kind of definition. The Buddha talks about faith. Faith in the Buddha. That the Buddha was enlightened, and that's quite important actually, because if you really have a lot of faith in the Buddha, then you really feel a lot of confidence doing even the difficult things in practice. But if you're not really sure, was the Buddha really enlightened? Was he just Hinduism's quite good too, and maybe Jesus was enlightened. But if you have the confidence that the Buddha really, if all of these people the Buddha knew what he was talking about, then it helps to do what's difficult, because some of the to go against our defilements is difficult. And it's also faith in the Buddha's teachings, often. Here it doesn't mention that, but faith in the Dhamma and faith in the Sangha. This is often those three go together. Here he talks about faith in the Buddha. And then virtue, and again, standard. Virtue means keeping the precepts, so that's a standard kind of definition of virtue. And this is how this leads to happiness. and to good rebirth. And then generosity. And again, the Buddha many, many times said how important generosity is and how, you know, bad stinginess is. You know, what was it, that quote? If you knew, he said to the monks, I think, if you knew what I know about the benefits of being generous, then you wouldn't let a single meal go by without sharing some of your food with someone else if there was some other being to share it with. You just wouldn't miss the opportunity ever. It's just such good karma you're making by being generous. The reason is because you're helping others, but also because you're freeing your mind and your heart from this inward looking, like me, you know, thinking about me. When you give to others, then you're just thinking less about yourself. So it helps your own spiritual practice. And then the odd thing is that here, wisdom is defined as these are the covetousness and unrighteous greed, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and doubt. These are the five hindrances. They're known as translated as the hindrances. And they usually come up in the context of when you're meditating. These things weaken your wisdom, but in particular, your meditation. So when the Buddha talks about getting into the jhanas, effectively the job of getting into the jhanas is to remove the hindrances. So if you're doing samadhi practice, samatha practice, you calm your mind down and the hindrances fade away. So they lead to concentration of mind. But here he's talking about the absence of the hindrances as being wisdom, which is kind of interesting because normally then, you know, concentration is one thing, and then you use that in investigation to develop wisdom. So it's odd. But again, it just shows how practical and how useful the removing the hindrances are. And the way that's done is through meditation. So again, this is pointing to he abandons them. To abandon the hindrances completely is... requires meditation practice. So again, the Buddha's talking to the lay people here, but he's recommending them to meditate. He doesn't say it specifically, actually. So I doubt anyone will say anything, because I've talked too much. But has anyone got something? Yes, please. Sorry? Oh, see, the four qualities. I don't necessarily often, very often, the kind of different groups of qualities and things that the Buddha talked about. He would often there would be like graduated things. They often come in a progression, but not always. So here, these four things, you can see that. Yeah, you can be a very generous person, but yet not really have... I don't think it's quite a graduation. You can well imagine how faith would lead to you... I mean, for me, that's what happened. My faith in the Buddha led me to kind of, you know, sharpen up my virtue. Didn't make me much more generous, actually. But, I don't know about the wisdom. That's not for me to say. But I think you can actually, you know, some people can be, you can be a very, very generous person, have a really good heart and so forth, but maybe just not know anything about the Buddha or not have much faith. So I don't think they're necessarily a progression. I think they're just four qualities of the mind you can have, I would say. Yes, exactly. Yes, exactly, yeah. No, but you could easily. I can imagine how you could. You could be very generous and hear about Buddhism and still not be impressed. You know, a lot of people hear Buddhist teachings and it kind of amazes me that they kind of think, "Oh yeah, that's all right," but it just doesn't seem to hit them. Yeah, to me it's a bit strange. But you can be virtuous, keeping the precepts, and not be generous. But of course, that comes first, I suppose. But yes, I can see how, you know, one would tend to lead to the other. But I think they're just different aspects of character. That's how I think of it. But maybe you're right. The tendency probably would be to develop them in this order. And wisdom wisdom comes at the end. You know, if you can only really develop wisdom when you've developed all the other things, all the other all the other good qualities. You know, you can't develop, again, the Buddha said it specifically, you know, unless you've perfected your morality, you can't perfect your concentration. Unless you've perfected your concentration, you can't perfect wisdom. So, we didn't work on that. Anyone else got anything to say? Okay, yeah. Sharing your meal. Yes, of course. Yeah. Yes, I mean, again, I think. Did you mention? I think he did actually, but I don't remember any specific quotes. But there are times when he talks. Again, I think in the Anguttara Nikaya, in this collection, he talks about there are these different types of giving, you know, and he lists different types of giving, you know. But generally, I think it tends to. And I can't specifically think of any, and it could be he tends to think of material things. But obviously, giving of your time is giving. You know, time is money. You know, whatever. But yeah, no, I mean, it's yeah, that's generosity too. The Sangha. Well, that's the thing. You can still be generous, like giving your time. You know, giving, you know, doing Sutta discussions. yeah, it's giving your time, and really that's mostly what the monks can give. But yeah, occasionally you can give material things. We can share with each other, that's the thing. Now, he was talking to monks when he said that, and one of the things he says about the things that create harmony in the Sangha, seven things, and he said is the monks share everything with each other, even down to the contents of their alms bowl, you know, even the food you get. So that's like in Thailand, you go on alms round, it's just, you don't just, you know, you get your own and you go back. Whatever you get an arms round, everyone comes back and we put it all into one big thing and then we share it out. It's not like, well, I was lucky today, it looks like you lucked out, you know. We share everything, you know. And also, like in the monastery, everything is shared. Most of the things we have, we don't consider to be ours, like the umbrella I'm using. It's not my umbrella, it's just the umbrella I've got. Came from the stores, it'll go back to the stores. And when a monk dies, there was a young monk. He lived here, actually, Panya Wudo. He died. He fell and broke his neck. He was only 35 in Thailand. And they got all his robes, all the possessions, put them out on a line. And the monks just took turns to help themselves to all his belongings after he'd, you know, after they cremated the body. And again, we just share it all just goes round, yeah. So that, yeah, what's mine is yours, kind of thing. But, you know, so we do, obviously we have a limited material goods, so we have limited opportunity to practice that kind of generosity. Yeah. So, were you going to ask anything?
Last
yeah. Yeah. Well, as I understand it, what it means is when you. Elsewhere, he says, oh no, it says it here actually, yes. And by doubt, you know, by that, he does what he should avoid and neglects his duty. This is the way it's translated. Elsewhere I've seen it translated, yeah. He does what he shouldn't do and he doesn't do what he should do. So, for instance, if you, I mean, say, take the last one, alcohol, you know. Hang on, we're talking about the hindrances here, not the precepts. Okay, so, but so take the, so the precepts, what they do, you know, they weaken wisdom, they cloud the mind, and there's this famous similes the Buddha give of muddied water and so forth, you know, water that isn't clear, and the different hindrances he compares to different things that make it so that you can't see a reflection in it. So that refers to the fact of them weakening wisdom. So they make you stupid, basically. So you think about it, like when you're really angry, when a person's really angry, you can't reason with them, yeah? So when you've got strong emotions, strong passions, then your wisdom goes out the window, and you do what you regret afterwards. You think, I'm going to go up there and I'm going to give them a piece of my mind. You know, and people say, oh no, don't, you know, leave it till later. You know, but you say, no, I'm going to do it, and then you do it and you regret it, and or overcome by lust. People think, you know, I know I've got a girlfriend or a boyfriend, but you know, it seems like a good idea to go and. You know, when you're overcome by lust to cheat, you know, it can be, you know, it can seem like a good idea to somebody to you know, commit adultery. And when lust isn't there anymore, it's like, why on earth did I do that? You know, jeopardize my marriage or so forth. So there's the aspect of doing what you shouldn't do. And then neglecting your duty means that, you do things, You don't do what you should do, so you're just a bit less diligent. For instance, again, overcome by these kind of things, people become, you can become lazy. These kind of things lead to laziness, like sloth and torpor, dullness. So there's just the two aspects. There really is just two aspects of just misbehaving, doing things you shouldn't do and not doing things you really should do. Just like not going to, not turning up to work and, you know. No, it just means the things you should be doing. So in other words, you know, you look after yourself, you eat properly, you've got a job, you go to work, you look after your family and so forth. These are the things you have to do, is what it means. So when we're in a foolish state of mind, you know, we tend to neglect the things we shouldn't, you know, and spend our time doing frivolous stuff and neglect the important things in life. So that's I think it simply means that. Anything else? Shall I go on, or has anyone else got any comments, questions? Okay. Well, I'll read on, next page. So these, householder, are the four things that lead to the obtaining of the other four things that are wished for, loved, and agreeable, yet rarely gained in the world. And that's why this is in the chapter 4 of the Anguttara Nikaya. With the wealth acquired by energetic striving, amassed by the strength of his arms, earned by the sweat of his brow, righteous wealth, righteously gained, the noble disciple undertakes four worthy deeds. What for? And again, I just point out that the idea is like amassing wealth, getting these material possessions, and, you know, Buddhism teaches renunciation, giving things up, but it's a very positive way the Buddha's talking about this here, because this is like, you know, righteously earned. In other words, you have a proper livelihood, so you're practicing right livelihood, not wrong livelihood. But, you know, by working hard, you amass wealth and goods and so forth. And this is a positive thing, because this is what lay life is about. This is what the family life is about. You need to bring home the bacon for your wife or your husband or whatever, and your children. And this is a good thing, energetic striving. And these are the kind of words he uses when he's talking about about practice as well, but amassed by the strength of his arms, earned by the sweat of his brow, and it's all very much righteous wealth. So that is like this is, and that's the word actually for righteous is dhammika, I think, which is related to the dhamma. So it's like dhamma is like what is right, the nature, what is natural. So dhammika, righteous or justice, is to, you know, in line with dhamma. So it's, you know, this is the right way to behave. So it's very positive, very very positive paragraph. So what for? What for? And again, what for worthy deeds does he undertake? With the wealth thus gained, he makes himself happy and pleased and properly maintains himself in happiness. He makes his parents happy and pleased and properly maintains them in happiness. He makes his wife and children, his slaves, workers and servants happy and pleased and properly maintains them in happiness. He makes his friends and colleagues happy and pleased and properly maintains them in happiness. This is the first case of wealth that has gone to good use, that has been fruitfully applied and used for a worthy cause. Again, I think that's really interesting that he's just saying, yeah, that's a word. He's speaking very prominently about, you've got your money, you enjoy it, you go and enjoy it, you spend it, basically. You don't, you're not a miser, you don't hoard it up and just kind of, you know, you enjoy your thing. So you make yourself happy, because that's what it's about, that's why you work. If you're not going to spend it, there's no point getting it in the first place. But also, not just yourself, but everybody. Everyone around you benefits. You know, if you're doing well, then you, your family, your parents, and your friends. You know, so this is a very positive thing, and that is wealth that has gone to good use, hasn't been wasted. Again, there's another story. I don't know where it's from. It's not in this collection. It's in the Sanghita, where one of the kings has just come back, sees the Buddha, and says, "Oh, where have you been?" He said, "Oh, I've been confiscating the possessions of a man who's just died, a very wealthy man who just died. And if you die without any heirs and without leaving a will, then just as, I mean, I think that's what happens today still, the government gets it. So this king's just been along to go and collect all the wealth." And he said, "This man," he said, was very, very wealthy. He's like a millionaire. He says, "But this is how he lived. He ate just broken porridge for his food. He wore kind of coarse hempen robes. He lived in this really grotty little shack." And the Buddha said, "Yeah, you know, he had a miserable life. In other words, he was a miser, so he had all this wealth, and he didn't spend any of it on himself. And the Buddha said that actually, that's this man. I know the karmic consequences. You know, the reasons behind this. And he says he was very wealthy because in many lifetimes ago he gave to a Buddha. He gave some food to a fully enlightened Buddha, and put food in his bowl. And that's such enormously good karma, that generosity, because the amount of good karma that you get, the punya, the merit, is usually translated, you get, depends on what you're doing, the intention in your mind, but also the person you're giving it to. And if you give something to a Buddha, it's like, whoa, you know, that's really supercharged generosity. But he said, but when he gave it to him, as soon as he did it, he regretted it, and he thought, I wish I hadn't done that. And because of that, he said, for many lifetimes since, he's been reborn rich. But because he regretted it, then he's been a miser in every single lifetime and hasn't been able to enjoy his food, any of this wealth at all, because he changed his mind and had this ungenerous thought immediately afterwards. In fact, I think he said he was reborn in a heavenly realm for many lifetimes. And then when he finally came back to a human realm, he was wealthy because of the generosity, but stingy and miserable because of the regretting it. So, that's an interesting little anecdote. But anyway, so there you go. So you share your wealth, those around you. Okay. Further, the householder with the wealth thus gained, the noble disciple makes provisions against the losses that might arise on account of fire and floods, kings and bandits, and unloved heirs. He makes himself secure against them. This is the second case of wealth that has gone to good use. So here's a really good, and again, so that has been fruitfully applied and used for a worthy cause. It's interesting to see the very practical nature of some of the Buddha's advice. So he's saying here is like basically you put some money aside for a rainy day. And against unloved heirs, which is presumably like kind of like lawsuits and people trying to get your money out of you, kings, you know, who might, you know, there was the tax man. Floods, fire, economic downturns, and so forth. You put money aside. So the Buddha's saying, you know, don't max out your credit card and so forth. You make sure you've got something for a rainy day. If things turn bad, what are you going to do? And this is the second thing. So as well as enjoying your wealth, you don't spend everything you have. You put some aside, because otherwise, when things turn bad, you're in big trouble. Very practical advice. Further, householder, with the wealth thus gained, the noble disciple makes the five kinds of offerings to relatives, guests, ancestors, the king, and the devas. This is the third case of wealth that has gone to good use, that has been fruitfully applied and used for a worthy cause. So again, this would traditionally, in society then, you would give gifts to your relatives, obviously, at the appropriate times, and guests, as in many cultures, give gifts, any guests and your relatives, the ancestors, so this would be kind of going, you know, putting things on shrines for the ancestors. So the Buddha doesn't, you know, neglect that and say, oh, forget that, that's weird, superstitious rubbish, you know. That's what people did, and so he wasn't, in many ways, the Buddha wasn't kind of iconoclastic in that way. He didn't try to kind of get rid of people's, you know, if it's not a harmful practice, the Buddha wouldn't just tell people to give up, you know, traditional practices if they were, you know, harmless. If they were like superstitious in the sense, in a way that would block spiritual progress, like, you know, bathing yourself in the river and the idea that will purify your sins, you know, that's kind of, that's harmful because, and it blocks your progress because for one thing, it tends to make you, if you have that idea, then you can kind of, oh, I'll just do this, but I'll just wash away my sins later, you know. And, you know, the Buddha would speak against that kind of thing. But there's nothing particularly wrong, presumably, about making offerings to the dead, putting flowers on the grave and so forth. Offerings to the king, you know, that's taxes, presumably. That just means paying your taxes. So you pay your taxes, that's another point. You don't not pay your taxes. And the devas. And again, I think that refers to shrines and things. They would have forest shrines and so forth, or like a shrine here and stuff. And you kind of, and I think they believed But no, the forest shrines it would be. I think they believe that the devas lived around there and they'd give offerings of food and things, as I understand it. So these are the five offerings. Further, householder, anyone who got anything to say about any of this? Just speak up any of these four things. Just put your hand up. Further, householder, with the wealth thus gained, the noble disciple establishes a lofty offering of alms to those ascetics and Brahmins who refrain from vanity and negligence, who are settled in patience and gentleness, who are devoted to taming themselves, to calming themselves, and to attaining nibbana, an offering that is heavenly, resulting in happiness, conducive to heaven. This is the fourth case of wealth that has gone to good use, that has been fruitfully employed and used for a worthy cause. These, householder, are the four worthy deeds that the noble disciple undertakes with the wealth acquired by energetic striving, amassed by the strength of his arms, earned by the sweat of his brow, righteous wealth righteously gained. So the last one is you give to kind of religious types, in other words, like monks or not just Buddhist monks. He doesn't specifically say the Sangha here. He says those ascetics and Brahmins. So he's really saying any, you know, people who live virtuous, renunciant lives, people who rely upon other people's generosity to live. So, and as long as they're virtuous, and yeah, they're, you know, genuine, you know, then these people should be supported. But he specifically, you know, he says Brahmins there, and you know, that refers to, and that doesn't refer to Buddhist monks. So this is the fourth thing. And you know, so what he's talking here to a rich man who has earned lots of wealth by the sweat of his brow and so on and so forth. So you know, this whole teaching is given to a man who is wealthy and has amassed a lot of wealth and is very generous, actually. But Natapindika was Natapindika means the feeder of the poor. It wasn't actually his name. He was just, everybody called him Natapindika, because even before he became a Buddhist, he was renowned for being a very, very generous man, and he was a philanthropist. He was a rich philanthropist, he became known as the feeder of the poor. And then that was even before he became a Buddhist, actually. And so it's a very appropriate teaching for him, though in a way he's probably preaching to the converted, but he's encouraging him. So lastly, for anyone whose wealth is expended on other things apart from these four worthy deeds, that wealth is said to have gone to waste, to have been squandered and used frivolously. But for anyone whose wealth is expended on these four worthy deeds, that wealth is said to have gone to good use, to have been fruitfully employed and used for a worthy cause. I can't resist mentioning that I was saying to Ajahn Brahm yesterday that the squandered and used frivolously, George Best, the footballer, English footballer, he became an alcoholic and he could have, his life was a mess, basically, after he became famous and rich. But he said once, I know I spent most of my money on women, fast cars and out drink. The rest I just squandered. But it's not quite what the Buddha's saying here. But I thought it was quite a good quote, though. Apart from the drink aspect, actually, you know, it's not such a bad thing, because what the Buddha is saying, anything other than these four things is gone to waste. It's quite a strong thing. He's saying anything other than these, you're wasting your time spending money on them. But bear in mind that the first one is you enjoy yourself. You enjoy what in the suttas they call the five chords of sensual pleasures. You know, so you buy yourself nice things, you go to the cinema, you go on holidays. And so all of that comes under the first of these four worthy things. So after all, apart from buying yourself nice things, buying other people nice things, saving money up, giving to the poor and to charity, and giving to the monks and religious people. Actually, what else do you do with your money? I mean, gamble it? That's a waste. I don't know. I'm trying to think. What else can you do with your money, actually? What else? What do people do with their money? Apart from... Yes, well, yeah. Well, people can see that as a way of livelihood, actually. But yeah, it's interesting, because that's kind of gambling, actually, in a way. You're effectively gambling. People convince themselves it's not gambling because it's like, oh, it's an investment and you get a return. But of course, they, you know, every 20, 30 years or so, they discover that actually you can lose it all, and it is gambling. Yes, that's a good point, actually. That's what else? Anyone think of a... I'm trying to think of something that doesn't come under these four things, you see. So is there anything else you do with it?
Another one is storing it in your mattress.
Well, yeah. Yes, that's right. So you put some aside for a rainy day, but if you put it aside and just never take it out, then yeah, it's a waste. That's what my dad did. My dad, he saved all this money up. He didn't earn a lot. You know, he was kind of worked in a factory, he was a toolmaker, but he saved loads of money, invested in the stocks. He was obsessed with the stock exchange and stuff, and saved it all up for when he was going to retire. And we couldn't imagine what he was going to do with it because he was such a habitual miser. I don't want to speak badly of the dead, but this is what he was like. He looked after us very well and everything, but he was a miser. And there was no way he was ever going to spend it when he retired because he just wasn't in the habit of spending his money. But in fact, then 6 months before his retirement, he had a stroke and that was it. And he couldn't talk, walk. And so all that time, all that money only went to waste, and it went to paying for his... Well, it went to us, basically, when he died. So it's it's really sad to just see. It's just waste, you know, instead of spending it on something useful. You hoard it, gamble it. You know, I can't think of anything else what people do with the money, really. Yeah, drink, of course, yeah. Drink and drugs. Sorry? Yeah. Well, that's the thing, because nowadays money and the financial thing, it's so complex, then the line between simply gambling and investing and like, or even, I say, people make their living and support their families from buying and selling stocks and commission they get on this kind of stuff. So, and it's like, you can't really, I mean, are they just gambling? I mean, it's not quite a thing. So there's no clear line, actually, with money now. It's become so complex and subtle. So it's a good point. I don't know, speculation. I couldn't say that the Buddha would say this, that, and the other. I got my own opinions, but I couldn't say what the Buddha would say about that. But I do tend to think that look at what he's talking about. But again, this was India 2,500 years ago. But he's talking about energetic striving, amassed by the strength of his arms, earned by the sweat of his brow. You know, it's not quite what you think about sitting, just sort of buying and selling things. And it is nowadays many people have jobs that aren't anything to do with producing anything. You know, they don't produce things. You just sell what other people produce and so forth. Very few people work in manufacturing and agriculture. So I don't know. It's hard to say. But if it gets to the stage where really you are just buying something and then just to sell it on and just to make the difference in the profit, I don't know that that's such a great, that you're adding much to the world. I don't know what other people think about that.
Is it just something to do with the intention of what you're doing? The intention is just to make money, to make more money. Instead of to make money so you can help other people.
These ways, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, but then if people are... I don't know, I guess there's... People like... what's his name? That rich Australian? Murdoch. He gets to the stage where it becomes just your life, really, just to make... It's not the things the money he's interested in, but the power or whatever, or the influence. It's just you're doing it to... It becomes an end in itself, really. And you don't know how much point it is to it. If at the end of it, like Bill Gates or this other guy, I've forgotten his name, Warren Buffett or something, you give away billions, you know... Then it's quite good, really. Like they're like the modern day Anata Pindikas, basically. This is a very good thing. Who can say? I don't know. But if you're, to speculating, I mean, there isn't that much difference in gambling and what they call speculating, on stocks and things. But as I say, it's a bit of a hard, it's no hard and fast thing. Many people, they do, as you said, worthy things. You're a stockbroker and you bring your family up with that money. I don't know. Right. Yes, that's right. And he talks of gambling, drinking, womanizing. Yes, that's the thing. I mean, that's the other thing. I think George Best was maybe a bit wrong about the women as well, actually. Yes, because basically you're spending a lot of money. I mean, you could, you might say, well, that's just making my friends happy. It's all these women friends I have. Yeah. But, that's probably not so wholesome, really, just kind of going to the casino, kind of lavishly spreading your money around and all these kind of you know, whatever. I don't actually ever been to a casino, I don't know. But I've seen the films, and they always have these bimbos hanging around as rich gamblers and stuff. Don't know if that's what it's like in Burswood or whatever it's called. Yes, it's probably, that's a frivolous, wasteful kind of thing, just throwing your money around. Yeah. Well, you know, giving to charity, I think, came under the third. Or is it, hang on just a sec, maybe wrong. Am I wrong? Actually, yeah, where's it about giving to the poor, the needy? I thought it was in there somewhere. Maybe it's elsewhere he talks about that. You make yourself friends, servants, friends and colleagues happy. That's just sharing your things. You put some aside. Guests, ancestors of the king and the neighbours. No. Ascetics and Brahmins. It's interesting, it doesn't talk about actually giving to the poor in this list, as far as I can see. So sometimes the translation, some of these things actually, you see different translations and they're completely different. Some of these things, when you get lists like guests, relatives, ancestors and devas, I'm sure elsewhere the Buddha talks about supporting those who can't support themselves. Yeah. Though again, he does actually elsewhere say that that's the kind of duty of a good king. Actually, so like it would be the government in this day, actually. So you know, you give your taxes to the king and he helps the poor. But I don't know, it's interesting. So, but your question was, though, which... What should you... Well, elsewhere, and I think it might even be in here, that somebody asks, who should you give to? Do you know where it is? What page it's on? Okay, yes. But what I mean is there is a sutta somewhere where somebody comes and asks the Buddha, who should I, you know, if you're being generous and giving, who should you give to? You know, what should you give to? An interesting question, like if you've got some money, it's like I want to give to charity. What charity should I give to? Someone asked me this recently. I said, well, the Buddha said, whoever inspires you, give to whatever you're inspired to. If you're inspired, if you think, you know, Battersea Dogs Home does a really good job and something, and give 15 million to look after these dogs. If that's what inspires you, do that. Yeah. If you're inspired to give to a homeless charity, give to them. If you're inspired to give to the kind of AIDS charities and so on and so forth. And then this person said, okay. And you know, where's the most benefit come? And said, well, that's a different question. You know, who should you give to and what gets the most benefit? But the third point, and he says, well, the most benefit comes from giving to highly virtuous people, like giving to a Buddha, basically. No. Giving to humans generates more merit for you than giving to animals. Giving to virtuous humans generates more merit still. But even giving to an unvirtuous human is of more merit than giving to an animal. But nonetheless, he doesn't say, so you should just give to very, very highly attained rich people. He said you should give to where you've got faith, because after all, if you have faith that, you know, this, even if the person's a rogue, if that's where your faith is, well, obviously that's what you should give to, because rather than just because someone else tells you that this is the best thing to give to. So wherever you yourself feel is the right thing to do, that's where you should make your gifts, because then it's the other aspect of the giving, of course, is what's in your heart, you know. And if you should be giving for the sake of, well, I think that this is who needs it. This is the person who needs it, so I'll give it to them. So he specifically said that. And when someone said, oh, right, so I'd heard people said that you always said people should only give to the Sangha and they shouldn't give to other religions and things. But it's good to hear you saying you should just give to whoever you've got faith in. And, of course, the Buddha specifically at times told people to give to other religions, actually. He told one person who converted to Buddhism, he said, well, carry on giving to your old religion. Don't just stop. And he's living. He was a merchant, I believe. He was a merchant, so he bought and sold goods and sent them and broaden things. But again, that could be the commentaries. I mean, that's, I know he's a merchant, but I don't know where I read that. So it could be that he... because there's lots about Anarthika Pindaka in the commentaries as well. Because he comes up again and again, and it talks... So there is a sutta that talked about his death, and he gets a teaching from Sariputta, and then he dies, and he gets reborn as a devata, comes back and goes to see the Buddha as a... Now he's a deva. And, but yeah, he was a rich merchant. In fact, I think he does specifically... say it actually, because when he, the time he first meets the Buddha, it's because he's on business to is it Sarvati? No, not Sarvati, to another city, Vaisali or somewhere, and he didn't know about the Buddha. And when he hears the word Buddha, when he hears the person says, "Yeah, what's going on? What's the business? You're really busy today, and what's happening tomorrow? Is something happening at your house because you're making a big fuss? Is there a big festival?" And he says, "Oh no, I've invited the Buddha for a meal." And when he hears that, he says, "What, there's a Buddha in the world?" And he's coming here tomorrow, and he was so excited he can't sleep and goes to see the Buddha and becomes a stream enterer straight away. He's got so much faith. So yeah, so he was there on business from this other city. He was a merchant. So again, they're amongst the wealthiest people in the world, really, merchants, people who buy and sell. Yeah, because a stream enterer means that you'll have at most, seven lifetimes. Doesn't necessarily mean human lifetimes. And, you know, who knows how many lifetimes. He's still there, probably.
Yeah. Oh, it doesn't mean...
Human lifetimes. No, it means rebirths. Oh. Rebirths. You might not come back to... You can have seven lifetimes. And so seven rebirths doesn't mean, like, oh, it won't be long before in Nirvana. Could be... Your first rebirth could last till the end of the universe, till the end of this cycle of the universe. You know? And Anartha Pindaka's probably still up there, basically. He's barely had an eye blink in his deva life. It's only been 2,500 years.
Unless he's been reborn as Bill Gates.
It's quite possible, yeah. But for the amount of merit he made, he'll be staying in the deva realm for a long, long time, I think. And maybe Bill Gates will too, actually, if he develops enough faith and wisdom. Anyone else got anything to... I mean, what time is it, actually? Because I don't want to... I can't see that clock. Okay, so it is time, but it doesn't mean you've got to jump up and go. But feel free to leave if you have to. Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously looking at another painter, I mean, he's a successful merchant. Surely he knows how to speculate in difficult situations.
So I couldn't hear that. Surely he.
He will be very skillful in speculating which good to trade and what price to charge.
Yes. Yes.
Going by the whole logic of the Buddhist teaching, it seems it's all underpinned by his faith and his virtue and so on, that to give him the skill to speculate well.
Give him
the skill. To speculate and to know what to trade.
Well, he was already rich before he even met the Buddha. So that's just his. They're kind of worldly qualities. Yeah, I mean, you could improve these kind of things with the spiritual qualities. They overlap. Energy is a kind of spiritual quality. And concentrate, you know, one-pointedness and so forth. And these things make you better in your worldly life as well as spiritual life. But many qualities that make you successful in the world don't particularly have many spiritual qualities. You know, being really good with numbers, you know, isn't particularly... not going to get you enlightened, but it's useful in the world. Or... So Anartha Pindaka was very, obviously very canny businessman. And probably helped that he was an honest man and so on and so forth. He worked hard and so forth. These are the reasons he... I don't know that this is Buddhism that helped him get rich, if you see what I mean.
I suppose his skills must be supported by goodness.
Yeah. Well, he was a good person, obviously, right from the beginning. That's why I say he was called Anartha Pindaka. Just from the man he was, you know. And according to the Buddha's teachings, that's why he was rich, actually, because if he was generous in this life, well, he was generous in the last life, you know. And when he does finally return, if he does return, take a human life again, he will be as rich as Bill Gates or, you know, someone like that, because of his generosity. Anyone else? Anything to ask or add, or...? Yeah, well, yes, he talked about wrong livelihood. I just want to say that please feel free to leave if you no longer want to listen to this and you know, don't feel it's rude to get up and go. Yes, in the teaching on the factor of right livelihood, the Buddha mentions wrong livelihood, and if I remember correctly, trading in. He only mentions a very few, a small list of things actually as wrong livelihood. At least in that place, it's trading in weapons, in poisons, in living beings, I think, which would include people, so like people trafficking. and I think under that you might kind of include, like, you know, getting involved in prostitution, as in, like, you know, running, you know, like prostitution rings and this kind of thing, pimping and whatever. That would, I think, would come under actually trading in human beings, really, trading people. So trading in poisons, living beings, weapons, sorry? Alcohol.
Arms.
Yes, weapons, yeah, arms. And alcohol, I think. Well, no. What it says is trading in living... does it say meat?
Yeah.
You could be right. If you've got it there, yeah. What page is that? Where is that? Yeah, okay. Trading in meat, okay. Yeah, it's interesting. It's like, well, I mean, if you're a butcher, I mean, a butcher would be long livelihood. And anything which is against the other kind of, the other factors of the Eightfold Path, you know, the precepts. So any job which requires you to lie, you know, when you're breaking that's obviously wrong livelihood as well. The actual, specifically, the things he mentions aren't very great, but there's a number of other things which should obviously be, you know, fraud. You make your living from fraud, or burglary. You know, that's wrong livelihood. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, if you have got your money by those things, then, you know, better not to make your money that way, bad ways. But if you are, then at least better it's still better to share it and so on and so forth. You know, but obviously the Buddha, he uses those phrases because he's encouraging people to kind of like, yes, earn a living, you know, righteously. You know, he's not missing the point of saying, but you earn it righteously and by the sweat of your brow and so forth. And also the point there is that it's made, you know, if you do earn it righteously by the sweat of your brow, by your work, then it's your choice then what you do with it. You know, it's your money. You know, so the Buddha could have upheld the idea of property. You know, if you've worked hard to make something, and then it's your duty, but also your rights and your privilege to spend that on yourself and on those you love. You know, so because whereas if you've stolen it, then it's not really so much your kind of your privilege. Yeah.
If you've made it through the wrong life,
yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, the generosity is still meritorious, but the stealing wasn't. You know, so suppose you stole it, to take an extreme example. If you're a thief, stealing, you're getting bad, you know, thingy, but then the generosity you're doing in sharing it is good merit. But that doesn't mean, and this is how people can be, it doesn't mean that you can get away and say, well, okay, well, I'll do a bit of fiddling on the side, but as long as I give enough to charity, that will make up for it. You know, because it doesn't work that way, and karma doesn't work that way. It's worth pointing out because actually people do think this way. And there's Ajahn Chah. I remember reading one of his things, talks to lay people, saying, "People, they're all going around wanting to make merit these days. You get busloads of them turning up at Wat Pah Pong, but nobody thinks about refraining from doing wrong. They just want to make merit." You know. And some of them, they take the precepts and they're drinking in the bus before they've even left the monastery. You know. And he said, it's like trying to dye a dirty cloth. You're not going to get much merit out of it because you haven't cleaned the cloth first. You know, the dye is like the merit. And the way the Buddha talked about it is that you can't cancel bad karma with good karma. It doesn't happen. If you make bad karma, you will get the consequences. That is the law of karma, is that you will get the consequences. But you can dilute it. So if you make a lot of good karma and a bit of bad karma, you'll suffer less from that bad karma than if you make hardly any good karma and a bit of bad karma. But you will still suffer from it. But you can't undo it. Yes, please, yeah.
Why does it give more karma
Yeah. Right. Well, look, it doesn't necessarily... If you save someone's life, you know, what you're giving, the gift of life to someone, is a bigger gift than the gift of a cupcake or something, or a spoon of rice to the Buddha. Yeah. But if you saved the Buddha's life, if the Buddha was starving to death, yes, freezing to death on the street, you know, they're saying, well, that would be... You know, yeah. This is something. Again, this is just a matter of taking it on faith from the Buddha. He's saying, you can see, and you can for yourself with our own wisdom, we're able to see that yes, doing generous acts and so forth is good for our mind and our hearts. And you can see how that works, and you see that aspect of the law of karma, how it works, and how if you're virtuous in this life, you'll be happy in this life. And I can see how that works. When it says that if you're virtuous in this life, then in future lives you'll be reborn heaven realms. The cause and effect, how that works, isn't something I can see. Or the fact that if you give to one person, not knowing that they're a Buddha, and if you give to another, the next monk in line, not knowing that he's just an ordinary monk and he hasn't achieved anything, the merit you make from the first gift is bigger than the other one. The Buddha said that's how the universe works. That is how it works, he says. I've seen it, the workings of karma, and I understand it, and that is how it works. And if you develop enough wisdom yourself, you'll see that. So it's like the laws of the universe, the laws of physics of the universe. The Buddha, all these things about karma and virtue and how they affect you are just natural laws. So the Buddha tells us that this is how it works. Yes, and I look at that and think, why would it necessarily be? I can see how it might be, but the Buddha said it is. Yeah. Yeah, come on.
If you give to a good teacher and give to a poor teacher, it multiplies, the act itself multiplies more.
Yeah.
Because the good teaching spread to more people. Rather if you're a more inferior teaching person, it just stops short.
Well, that's one aspect.
I guess that's
one aspect, actually. I mean, if you help... Well, that's what I think that's not the whole story, but that's a good point. That's a very good point, is that obviously if you support the Buddha and you're helping him... You know, in his teachings, basically. And obviously then there's more good coming of that than if you were to give to, you know, an unvirtuous person. That's a good point, actually. I don't think that's the whole story, though, because it's hugely... because it also says if you give to just a person who, say, keeps the eight precepts, then that's hugely more beneficial than giving to somebody who doesn't keep the precepts. And again, it's hard to see quite of what effect. But yeah, I think that's got a lot to do with it, I suspect. Yeah, that's good. But that's one of these things, it's just the Buddha says that's how it works. And you know. But at the end of the day, anyway, he said, give where you've got faith, so that's what you need to, don't need to worry about that. The thing is, he says this is what you get from giving, but when you're giving, you shouldn't be thinking about what you're going to be getting. It's not what you need to focus on anyway. So it's not really important for us to be considering, where will I get the best returns on my generosity? You know, so even if we're not really convinced that that's true about giving to arahants is better than giving to ordinary people, it doesn't matter anyway, because if you're being generous, you're doing the right thing.
Is that a conscious thing, though? I mean, if I was to give some money to somebody, I didn't know their status.
Yeah.
I don't know what the benefit is or not, but I just saw a need to give, but I wanted to give.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's not just that if you give and because that will obviously have an effect. But even if you don't know, as I understand the Buddha's teachings, he's saying that even if you don't know who they are or what they are, you will get, it's just in itself, partly because of what this woman said, actually. I mean, you know, it's going to make a difference. But and for whatever reasons, I don't know. But so even if you don't know who you're giving to, so it's kind of potluck. Which is why the Buddha said, like, when you're giving gifts to individual monks, he said, don't give the gifts to individual monks, give to the Sangha. And it's more merit. So that, and he told his stepmother, I think it was, trying to give something to him, and he said, don't give it to me, give it to the Sangha. It's more merit to give it to the whole Sangha, because everybody gets a share. Even more merit than giving to a Buddha.
Yes.
Well, you can. We're giving to the Sangha, you mean? Well, that's why we do this Sangha Dana chant. Anyone who's been to the, you know, well, to the monastery or the meal here on Saturday and Sunday, people do this chanting when they give the things. It's not necessary. It might help focus your mind, and it can be useful. They do this chant saying, this is for all the Sangha and to be shared amongst all the Sangha. But, I mean, you know, as long as you've got the idea in your mind, it's not really important to say the chanting. It's not that important to make sure you're giving to the Sangha. I mean, when you give these things, if you give a big load of toilet rolls to hand them over to me at the meal, I mean, I think everybody knows. It's, well, yeah, these are for you, Ajahn. Yeah. and you just kind of understood that, well, this is to share, you know. And you know that, really. But I suppose the more you make it clear in your mind what you're doing. So when you give, it's good to kind of to be clear that you're doing it, not just to do it offhandedly. The Buddha, again, he talks about, and I think it's in here in this book, about the ways of giving and how you do it. And if you just do it in a kind of offhand kind of way, it's not so good as if you do it very clearly and consciously. Also, better to give with your own hand, rather than just to say, you know, okay, there's this, and you might have a standing order and give and think that's good to do. But to actually give with your own hand, because it makes far more impression in your mind, you know. So to actually go to the trouble, which is why we do this thing of, like, there's all that stuff there that could just be put in the front and put in the car and taken to the monastery. But everything gets handed individually to the monks, one by one. But then everyone then, you know, has their moment of giving, you know, and they're actually, here it is, I'm giving it to you, and you take it. So that's a more powerful effect on the mind. But the best kind of giving is just when you're just giving, you think, oh, you know, there's somebody who needs something there, and you give without any thought of, you know, what you're going to get out of it, or anything, or don't even think about I'm giving, and like don't make it clear, oh, I'm giving to them now. You're just like, oh, you need that. You know, I've got one here. You know, here, have this. You know, and it's just that this is here. It's better off there. You know, and there's no sense of me giving to you. That's the highest kind of giving, where there's no thought of giving at all. You're just doing what's appropriate. Spontaneous and just natural and completely selfless.
And I always think, well, when you give to Salvation Army or any of those organizations, I do hear people saying sometimes, oh, I'm not going to give to them, you don't know if it gets through to the people or all the gets through. And I say, well, you give, that's the end of it for you.
Yes. That's right, yeah. I mean, but on the other hand, I mean, people can sometimes use that as an excuse for not giving to anyone. but if that's your reason, say, for not giving to them, but giving to someone else, I mean, again, the Buddha said, that would be in line with what the Buddha said about, well, give where you've got faith. So if you don't have faith in the Salvation Army, then, you know, give to Oxfam. You know? I think most of the money, if you give to Oxfam, most of the money goes to where it's supposed to go to. But if you don't have faith in them, give to whoever else. Yeah. But if you just use that excuse not giving to anyone, then yeah, it's like then 0% of your gift is going to anyone. So it's a cop out, isn't it? Yeah. But yes, exactly. You don't have to worry about what they do, or even if they embezzle it afterwards. You know, that's their karma. Yeah. Obviously, if you think they might embezzle it, then don't give to them. But it's a good point.